I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do.
Kristen Ann with us. She's the author of Exploring Sacred Space, a vast quest, a very vast quest. Kristen spent more than a lifetime studying spirituality and metaphysics. Her life's been one of very unusual experiences, encounters, and constant coincidences that have added to her studies, deepening her understanding of life at its core levels. She had a near-death experience as a child, which instilled a sense of knowing that there are many more levels of existence than the physical one that we see. And so she began her lifelong quest as a child, reading any spiritual and metaphysical books she could find, starting in the mid-60s. And in the mid-70s, she studied the research and findings of the profound clairvoyant Rudolf Steiner. And her two-year studies of Steiner were greatly enhanced by having Professor Werner Glass, who has also provided a level of clairvoyance. And let us say, Kristen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Kristen, we see a lot of life. You walk out in the morning, you take a look at what's out there, but most of us really don't see. We don't experience everything that there is because we're so busy all the time. How do you break through that? How do you break through that busyness and see what's really there that's in front of your eyes, but most of the time is invisible?
Right. It's definitely an art form, you know, to step back and see a little bit more. There are so many more deeper levels to life than we usually see. Some people, myself included, meditate as often as we can, like for 20 minutes, half hour every morning if we can. And this really seems to open your awareness to things, to sharpen your awareness.
Yeah, you know, we live in a kind of an interesting world now. I go all the way back. I was brought up in the 50s. And being brought up in the 50s as a teenager, for the most part, it was a different feeling. I'm going to say it was a different consciousness. Everything felt different. The vibration was different. It was one of those kind of places where you didn't have to lock the door when you walked out.
Right.
There wasn't sense of. But then we bring it fast forward to today. There's a completely different feeling moving through, I'm going to say this planet, not just the country. And
right,
it seems
right,
like
right.
It's stimulated by fear.
Yes, very much. It's hard to exactly pinpoint what happened, but I explain in my book, which you can see that at exploringsacredspace.com, I explain how the energy is very much changed now on the whole planet. And from my studies of clairvoyant Rudolf Steiner and with a clairvoyant professor, we learned that there is a big transition going to happen in our lifetimes. And in order for this to happen in the best way possible, energy, it was explained to us, and this just blew our minds, it was explained that energy needs to be streamed toward Earth from the mid-last century onward. Energy would be increasing and increasing. Things would be changing and getting faster and faster as we neared the beginning of the 21st century and beyond. And we can see that happening. I mean, all the things that I learned, I can see happening and taking place.
You know, there's an interesting word that we really have to take a look at. And that word, and I know you deal with it constantly, that word is transition. Most people are frightened to death of transition. Transition is as simple as you're single, you get married, now you're transitioning into another way of living your life. Most people are frightened to death of what they don't know. How do we transition into this with the ability to be able to deal with it when it comes?
Right. Well, the reason I wrote this book is to, you know, there's been so much negative speculation out there about the transition and 2012. I wrote the book to share some a more factual view of what will be happening, and it's nothing to be frightened of, but the book is very important because there are elements in there that teaches you how to prepare. The transition will be is something that actually has happened roughly every 13,000 years on this planet throughout history. And I show a diagram of that. You can find it on the website, exploringsacredspaces.com, if you click on the chapters and chapter 2. But this transition will be different from all others in the past. It's going to be a very uplifting one. And now, I explain in the book why it's different.
Let me just add something to this, which I think is very interesting. And this is has nothing to do with political left, right, and different, like this one, don't like that one. That's not where I'm at with this. But the December 21st, the 2012, is a month after the presidential election right here in this country. And it's going to be very interesting, to see what happens. Yes. Interesting timing on this thing.
Right, it is. You know, what I found so interesting about that date, and my professor never mentioned that date. When we would ask him when things are going to happen, he would always say, no one knows the exact date or time, and that phrase is actually said in the Bible. But it's interesting that in addition to the Mayans saying that time will no longer continue the same, and I note here that they never said time would end. They only said that time will no longer continue the same. But scientists also have stated factually that there is a major alignment happening on that very date. And they know there will be some effects on Earth, but they don't know what it is. So it's my understanding that there will be, this transition will be a refinement into a different level of being.
Okay, now when we talk about a different level of being, is that physical? Is that emotional, mental? Is that a way, or are we going to think differently and view the world differently, which would cause us to act differently? Or are we physically going to go through some kind of a transformation that that will set that base for everything else that's going to happen? Are we going to look different?
Well, here's where no one really can tell you the exact scenario, but the difference between my book and anything else that's been written is I've given the clearest information on this that no one else has been able to give to date. But no one knows exactly what it's going to be like, except that from everything I've learned, as science fiction, you know, as wildly sci-fi as this sounds, we are going to be transitioning both through time, and this would explain the Mayans' way of saying that time will no longer be counted the same. We are going to be transitioning into the future, and several different credible sources have said this, as well as into a finer state of being where our bodies will not be quite so physical. But it will be a very uplifted and happy state.
Now this brings up an interesting
nothing to
point.
Be afraid of.
Okay, but this brings up an interesting point. You know, when you say nothing to be afraid of, for people who have the ability to see beyond and look through, okay, viable statement. But for those people who don't know, it's got to be absolutely frightening. And from what I'm hearing you say, that you better prepare for it. Because if you are not emotionally ready, not physically ready, not intellectually ready, if you're not emotionally ready, spiritually ready, you could not make that transition.
No, it's not that fearful. Basically, anyone, and that is why the energy has been raised so much, as I understand it. So that there is, you know, all these new age movements and new awakenings and understandings and new levels of sharing. Basically, everyone who is a good person will be making this transition. you don't have to worry that you're not in the right emotional place. It's only those who are very negative, who have more evilness in them who will not be. As I understand it, and here is another element that will sound very sci-fi and hard to understand, but there will be actually a split in realities. Those whose energy is not quite ready to make this transition, to continue their growth on a different place, in a different place, a new earth, if you'd like to call it that, there will be a different reality for them to continue on in the more physical dimension.
Okay, but still, if you're not prepared for that, what can happen? If somebody is literally not prepared for that to occur, they're not going to make it.
No, I would not say that. I would not understand it that way. I think that anyone who is a basically good person is going to make it.
Okay, but what is it basically? What is a basically good person? If I go to the Middle East, and by the way, I'm on your side of the table with this, so don't hear that I'm trying to block it in any way, because I'm with it 100%, maybe 200%. But you take somebody in the Middle East, it all has to do with something called ethics. Ethics is not ethics is balancing how you are on the inside and acting like that on the outside. If you're a killer on the inside and you kill on the outside, you're being ethical in your world. All right. So if we go to, let's say, Middle East, and when they torture and they kill people and they do whatever they do, is this evil? Is this saying that a particular mindset, a particular culture is going to die out because they're not going to be able to match up to this mindset? That's the question.
Right. As I understand it, that element that still harbors a lot of vengeance and negativity will have the opportunity to grow, still continue on in this more physical level as we know it. They are not, as I, interpret it, they would not be ready to make it to the next level with the rest of us.
Yeah, because
and yet they will be given every opportunity to continue to grow to the point where one day they will make it to the next level.
Okay, but if I think that I'm living life the right way, if I think that I'm prime example, in some cultures, in some religions, if your daughter is not doing what you want your daughter to do, or your wife, you can take her on the back and shoot her, and you're fine. It's within the law. Now, in that particular religion, that's a right thing to do. My world, it isn't. But at the same time, I'm not in that world. So how do you tell someone that they don't have the right consciousness, or they're not doing the right thing? They've lived all of their life believing in a certain way, following the path of what they would consider the God and spirituality. Now, all of a sudden, they find out that it might not have been the right thing to do.
Right, right. You know, each different civilization sort of lives within, if you'd like to call it, a group soul, a way of being. And who's to say? But I would think that in those cases, there is still a lot more growing, a lot more awakening to do. And, I'm not one to say or to pass judgment, but they may need to grow more in the physical dimension first before making that transition.
Sure. But I don't think that there's judgment in the question. The question is...
Right.
Truly right. You know, what is truly that...
If you truly think it's right, yeah. It's a hard one to say.
Sure. And there's all those variables to come into play, but from what I'm hearing you say, the interesting thing that will happen with the transition, the judgments, and there will be judgments if you're one of the bad guys, whatever that means, and you're not going to get there, then there is a judgment, and the judgments will be beyond what we as human beings have set as staples, as rules to live by. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. I'm going to be here. I'll make it. And as a matter of fact, on the 22nd of December, you should be back on the show, and we'll talk about what happened.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, I really believe that. We're starting to, we've got about a minute or two to run out of time. So I pick up the book, and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? Kristen, what do I get that I didn't have before I read this book?
You will have more of an understanding of our point in time and why it is that we are transitioning and why this is necessary. And also, the other beings who are playing a part of this, in this, the masters and the hierarchy who have been living incognito among us, and how they are helping us, how they are helping this whole thing to take place. It's all a fascinating concept.
When you talk
and
concept,
that you really have to read.
Yeah, I know. But when you talk concept, though, when you realistically talk concept, you've got to be able to believe this. You've got to be able to prepare yourself for it. And my feeling is this: if nothing happened, you still got a year to go. And within that year, why can't you promote being the very best you can be? And if it doesn't happen, look what you've gained, look what you've garnered in your life.
Right, right. And the book states that, you know, I'm not saying that it is going to happen on this date, but it just could, you know. In fact, someone named Drunvalo is saying 2016. We don't know, but what we do know is there will be a transition in our lifetimes in the not-too-distant future.
Well, there would have to be, based on what's going on today. And and one of the reasons I would say that there would have to be, there is such confusion going on. There's confusion in the world. There's confusion in this country. I bet if I walk down the street in any given major city in this country today, and I said, what is an American, you would probably get a very much different definitions and so on and so forth. There was a time we knew who we were. That's getting lost, so something's got to happen. And with that, Kristen, we're starting to run out of time. One more time, please, with your website.
The website is exploringsacredspace.com.
Okay, can we buy the book?
And you can see the whole list of chapters, and you can even click on them to see the illustrations and to read an article about the book.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for being here. I'm serious. We have a date, the December 22nd of this year.
Wonderful. Great. Well, Happy New Year.
Oh, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Wendy Lynn Phillips with us, the author of Naked to Knockout, Beauty from the Inside Out, offers 25 years of expertise in the beauty industry. She's coached thousands of women in the area of image, style, beauty, the value of compelling presence. Again, she's the author of Naked to Knockout, Beauty from the Inside Out. She's also hosted her own Naked to Knockout TV show, and that's aired in Florida, featured in a recent issue of Think Healthy and Style magazine. Wendy, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael, for having me on. I'm excited to be here and share a little bit about how to have a new year and be a new you.
You know, a very interesting thing, and I've watched it over the years. I've been into definitions for so long. If you got a common definition with someone, you can move forward, you can work with it. But if you don't have a common definition, no matter what you say, it doesn't really mean anything. And one of the words that has really transitioned into different definitions, especially today, is the word beauty. So can we start out and say, Wendy, what is beauty? What do we talk about when we say beauty today?
Well, it is a great word, and you know, the saying goes, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And so to answer that in a quick two-word or even sentence answer, I definitely address that in my book, because true beauty, for what I believe, may not be consistent around the world. And, you know, I believe there's a perfect blend and a balance, which is why I titled the book Beauty from the Inside Out, because initially what captures the eye may not be what you find out true beauty really is. And so as a woman ages, you know, a lot changes with our body shape and our face, and you know, oftentimes some of the sweetest, most beautiful women to a certain man is that woman he's grown old with. And she doesn't look at all like the one she married, but she's certainly the most beautiful to her. And, you know, I think of beauty, and things are beautiful. The birth of your baby is beautiful. A sunset right here on the West Coast, or a sunrise in Florida, is another definition of a beautiful thing. And so trying to define it really is the challenge. But I think that for purposes of image and dressing for success and being the most beautiful you that you can be is a combination of presenting your best self to the world, both physically and with character. You know, a woman that has pep in her step and tends to know where she's going and has her head held high is often a beautiful woman regardless of her features.
You know, from what I'm listening to you say, there's two beauties that we're dealing with. There's the beauty of self that, you know, I've seen women that from time to time, somebody would say, what do you think? And I'd say, gorgeous. And they say, oh, kind of average and not in my eyes. All right. Now, right. But the two kind of beauties would be this. There's the kind of beauty that you have around you, the kind of beauty that maybe that someone special you're with has. And then there's the beauty of presence, the acceptable beauty to be able to make whoever you are, whatever you are, work in the world today. So there are two. One is learned. The other one is just natural.
Right. Right. I agree. I think that's a simple way. And yet, while it still doesn't succinctly define it, it does give us all a working definition that we can relate to.
Yeah. Now, most women If you ask them, how do you look? They're not going to say beautiful. And they're taught not to say beautiful. We are taught not to give everybody the best that we think we are, so we hold it back, which I think in the world out there, it's totally wrong. There's a difference between ego and being confident in yourself.
It's true. It's true. I think another one of my personal pet peeves, Michael, is when you do try to give another woman a sincere compliment, she often brushes it away, you know, and you say, oh, that dress looks really great on you. Oh, no, I picked it up at the thrift shop. I just got it at the consignment. Oh, I got it on sale. Instead of looking at the person and appreciating their compliment and saying, yeah, thank you. You know, I mean, I liked it. That's why I bought it. You know, it's kind of funny to me, not that that's the proper way to respond, but to just be able to even receive a compliment with gratitude, I think, is almost a lost art.
No, by the way, the word compliment doesn't seem to hold any strength anymore with most of the places that you go. People have forgotten to either be complimentary, they've forgotten to be caring about other people. You know, we live in a very interesting world. And if we could do some breakthroughs, and I'm not going to say the way it used to be, there's always been a little bit of a problem, but especially today. Today is when we have, quote-unquote, all of these independent thinkers, men and women, who really aren't independent thinkers, but they think they are, and there's where the problem lies. So I really believe in complimenting somebody. There's got to be an art to do that. There's also an art to accepting the compliment. These are learned skills. They don't just come naturally anymore.
That's true. It's true, and a sense of graciousness. I think, again, you know, to compliment someone first is to notice, you know, and if our faces are on our iPads and iPhones, and when we aren't even noticing the beauty around us, we aren't even hardly noticing the person in front of us that we're talking to often, if, in fact, we're on such a tight schedule, we're thinking about the next appointment, we're running to the next place, we've got our phone in the ear, and we're kind of halfway having a conversation with someone, instead of looking right eye to right eye, which is number one rule for conveying sincerity and confidence. Again, our children, I'm an advocate for teaching them to shake someone's hand when you meet them and look them in the eye and say your name clearly, you know, be able to speak clearly, look at someone in the face and appreciate, say their name back, acknowledge meeting them. Even something simple like that, you know, I don't know, maybe not a lot of people think that's important, but to me it does. And I think it's the beginning of developing healthy self-confidence and a healthy self-image.
No, oh, absolutely. It was kind of interesting that in how we see things. I picked up a copy of, I was waiting for something, I picked up a copy of People magazine, and there was I'll leave her nameless, but there was a particular actress who happens to be gorgeous, and there was a picture of her in there, and she was dressed, and she was dressed to the nines, but if you took a real good look at her, the tattoos that were hanging out, the sleeve of her dress, the look on her face, the weight she had lost, and there was something very sad in that face. She's losing her beauty.
You're right. You're right. And often it's the smile that's hiding behind the mask. And we all know the media certainly doesn't portray the truth in a picture, in an image. And that's a huge part of body image and health. And one of my consistencies throughout the book is look in the mirror and like what you see. And again, that's just a statement that really is something that comes a lot more than just what's on the outside. We've got to learn to balance your container, which is the outside, with the contents. And I think that's perhaps the lost art. And the sad part.
Now, by the way, I know one of your talking points, you talk about, you know, that why look savvy and feel sensational whether you're in sales or not. You're always in sales. You
absolutely.
Don't have to sell it. Yes. You got
absolutely.
It.
You're set. I hope after 18 years of marriage, I'm still selling myself to my husband. You know, I want to be the number one woman in his life. And so I'm selling that. I'm selling peas and carrots to a four-year-old, and I'm selling myself and my services, and I sell product. So I think that all women, whether you're a teacher and you're selling education, you're literally in sales or not, you're absolutely right. And so I'm a strong proponent of feeling confident and conveying that professionalism in whatever genre of work that you do.
Now, by the way, very interesting thing that, you know, flattering your figure starts with identifying it and, you know, featuring your best asset and so on and so forth, which is all well and good. My sister mentioned something to me the other day, and I saw it. The last time I went out and bought jeans, I got these skinny jeans, and they really fit right, okay? And then I'm bigger on top than I am on the bottom. And I had another pair of pants on the other day, and I said, what do you think these look like? And she looked at me, and she said, you match. She said, when you're wearing those other jeans, they look good, but they don't match the top. And I really believe that a lot of people run into that problem. It's called identifying, you know, what it is and working with what you got, but doing it in such a way that you look at it not only through your eyes, but how you're seen.
Well, that's right. And so there's basically, you know, four body shapes. And what you just described was the upside down pear. You know, most women can easily identify with the little pear body shape. That's a little smaller on the top, maybe smaller body frame, bone frame, shoulders, and or chest. And then clearly it's easier to visualize the little pear, or what we refer to as the less than flat middle. And so wanting to minimize that by, for instance, shoulder pads in a jacket or something that creates a little more horizontal and attention up at the neck. And jewelry can do that for a woman, hair, makeup, you know, drawing attention on the upper half of her body is a good way to do that. Another great way to elongate is to stay solid and neutral on the bottom half. For instance, if, you know, a khaki skirt, nude hose, and taupe shoes all distracts attention away from that bottom half of the body, and it actually elongates and makes you look taller. So for a man or a woman, the principle is the same, but you're right. It's identifying the body shape that you are and then learning to dress according to it.
Let me give you a visual on that, okay? Schwarzenegger on top and Twiggy on the bottom.
Right, right. Yeah, not so good. When that happens, the skinny jean is probably not the best thing to wear.
They got it.
Right. There you go.
Baggy, here I come. But,
yeah.
But it really comes down to it. It's knowing how to accentuate your best parts, how to take those that maybe you need to build or work with or something and work with it in such a way that it blends.
That's right. Creating harmony, balance, harmony, balance, harmony. For instance, another boo-boo, if you will, that a lot of men, I see often, and perhaps, again, it's just a faux pas. They don't know. You know, they just simply don't know. If you're shorter than 5'7", 5'8", as a man, that, you know, that's considered almost short, and you may be less than average body shape, really a mustache creates a more of a horizontal line than a vertical one. And so oftentimes it's better to lose the mustache and, you know, unless you're taller.
Okay, so far in this interview, this is my takeaway so far. I'm growing a mustache and I'm buying baggy pants tomorrow.
Well, good. All right. So glad I could help. Yes, I'll be happy to go shopping with you, too.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, by the way, I picked the book up, Naked to Knockout. I read it page by page, cover to cover. Wendy, what's my takeaway? What do I, Michael, get as a human being, man or a woman, out of the book? Because from what I'm hearing, it crosses the gender line.
It really does, and you're going to get stories in there from everything, current reigning Miss Florida, who she too didn't like what she saw in the mirror. And there's, of course, extremes from every end of bulimia and anorexia to, you know, the complete other end of feeling beautiful and like a knockout as a 70-year-old, you know, beautiful woman. I had an incredible interview with Mitzi Perdue, who is the wife of the late Frank Perdue of Perdue Chicken, and just a lovely, lovely, incredible, beautiful woman on the inside and out. She shared great tips. At the end of each chapter, I've got a call to action. It's actually a step up and step out in style. So there's great little to-dos where you really can take the tips that I give you and work both on your outer shell, the container, and, of course, the contents as well, and develop character and, you know, learn to develop healthy self-esteem, deal with the things in life that perhaps have been obstacles, and really learn to turn them into an opportunity for good. And that's my main message.
And I love every second of that one. Wendy, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at and buy the book.
Great. Thank you. It's on Amazon, Amazon.com, either under my name, Wendy Lynn Phillips, or, of course, by the book title, which is Naked to Knockout. And the website is the same, nakedtoknockout.com. And I did want to mention you can get a free style guide. It's just a short little style guide with great pictures, the meaning of color. By the way, I wanted to give our listeners a hot sneak peek into the number one color for 2012. Have you heard what it is yet, Michael?
No, not at all.
It's Tangerine Tango.
Tangerine Tango
is the number one predicted color by Pantone, and they pretty much set the tone not only for fashion but also for home decor. And so if you want to be in, they're predicting that 2012 is going to be a year for optimism and energy. You know, tangerine's kind of a blend of that yellowy orange with a little bit of pink in it. So a sunset, hibiscus-type color. So there's color charts in the book, and the style guide has some great pictures. It's my free gift. All you have to do is share your name and email. That's on my website, which is nakedtoknockout.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Wendy, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, you're welcome. Coco Chanel always said, Michael, I'd love to just, you know, finish with a quote from her. You know, she said, dress shabbily, and they remember the dress. Dress impeccably, and they remember you.
Love it.
Yeah.
Okay. Good night.
Thank you so much. Have a happy new year.
You too.
And a hand to hold the leaves begin to fall. And a love who's burning light will warm them in a night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You were listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Tony Elliott with us. He's the author of EnviroClowns, The Climate Changes Circus. He's been writing for more than 20 years now. He's a weather climate researcher as well as a political writer. He writes for 20 different publications, online magazines, including UFO Digest, the American Chronicle, the Cyprus Times. His articles are shared by many websites and read by millions of online readers. Tony Howe, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Tony, the one thing that I have learned over the years about the environment, it makes some people a whole lot of money.
Yes, it does.
Realistically, when you looked at this, when you decided to write the book, what was that trigger point for you to say, I'm going to put this to pen?
Oh, of course, it's been going on for quite some time, even back in the 70s, you know, when it, in its birth, really. But more recently, the catapult for me was the wind farms, so many wind farms, and the numbers as far as what they were putting out, they were taking, you know, like the IPCC and the WMO, just didn't match up as far as the actual temperatures were concerned.
Okay, but
so I just started researching and come up with this book.
Yeah, but Tony, somebody's got to buy this, and that's where I think the problem is. Are we getting led down, quote-unquote, the garden path? I mean, look at this last debacle with the White House and the rest of it. We don't have to get into it, but we're talking about things that aren't working, and we're spending billions of dollars on it, and there are people who will jump off a cliff to prove that, you know, the environmental, you know, circus is right, and it's a circus. There's no question about it.
Well, yeah, it ends up costing the consumer more than anything else because the government subsidizes all of these wind farms and programs like that, and plus the solar utilities, that type of thing. And every time the government subsidizes something, you know that the taxpayers are going to be the ultimate people that are responsible for paying it.
Sure.
Not to mention the fact that all of this is actually causing everyone's utility bills and everything like that to go up.
Yeah, and by the way, look at Al Gore, for instance. With all due respect, that man has made tens of millions of dollars on global warming. And the real question here is this. In all of your research, Tony, what have you found? Are we really dealing with a reality with global warming, or is it just a facade?
I think it's all a facade from what I've come up with. The very fact that this man, Al Gore, bought a multi-million-dollar mansion on the beach in Southern California, to me, proves that he doesn't think the ocean's going to be rising anytime soon.
No, we don't look at that, though. He glommed onto something, and it was good, and we spent all of this money. But what do you think it is?
Some of these articles that are coming out all the time, you know, as far as climate change, global warming, is like a few years ago. Use this one, for instance. They used Moore Island off the coast of India and Bangladesh out in there, in that area of the world, as an example of a rising sea level caused by global warming that just completely inundated the island and forever. But on further inspection of the area and geographically and everything like that, you know, the island itself was built up from silt from a hurricane in that area back in the 70s, you know. And the whole island itself isn't but a few inches above sea level, and it disappears on a daily basis with the high tide. So, I mean, it was a very, the article itself is just outrageous as far as that goes, you know?
No, by the way, when we deal with global warming, and I don't know what's been going on in this last year, but I'm in right outside of Milwaukee. I'm about an hour and a half out of Chicago. It hasn't snowed yet here, you know, and I've been up here for about 6 years now, or down here. I've been here for about 6 years now, and usually there's snow and whatever, and you're digging your way out of the driveway. That hasn't happened, and the weather is just a little bit warmer. And then at the same time, we see all these things going on in Japan, which literally almost destroyed Japan. What happened in the States, Joplin, Missouri. I mean, the list goes on. This last year has been really strange when it's come to the weather, and I don't think it's got anything to do with global warming, but there's something going on.
Well, as you know, climate is like weather. It does change. I mean, as far as climate change, the idea of it goes, yeah, climates will change all the time. I think you're going to have extreme weather in any type of climate, no matter what you do or whether it's warming or whether it's not, but there are always going to be extremes in weather events like tornadoes and hurricanes and that type of thing. And I think this year especially, in 2012, we can look forward to a year of extremes, especially since the sun's going to be very active, this year.
Now, by the way, one of the things I think is absolutely ludicrous is the hybrids. Okay, so you can get 40 miles an hour or 50 miles the gallon out of it. You know, wonderful. But you're going to spend $70,000, $80,000 for one. Somewhere people aren't looking at what's going on here.
And you're not going to be able to go over 80 to 100 miles until you have to stop and recharge again for a few hours.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's no question
about
it. And
that power is coming from the power company. So, I mean, you're still using fossil fuels and doing that.
Yeah, now we're going to have to do something. There's no question about it, because fossil fuels, there will be a day when there won't be any, not in your lifetime or mine, but there's going to have to be a time where we're going to have to find some alternative source. There's no question about
but
that.
But we do need something that works. And as I see it right now, the wind farm situation, the solar energy situation, those two type of energy sources are so infantile, are so in the infantile stage right now that I think they shouldn't even be used in the market.
No. As a matter of fact,
because they're not generating enough electricity to even really be on the grid.
No, absolutely.
It takes actually more electricity to get these wind farms, to get these turbines going, than they'll ever produce. The solar panels, they actually use more in fossil fuels in their manufacture than they're ever going to give us.
The problem I think that we're having is this. If somebody stands up with fact and stands up against this, somehow somebody's going to find something that's going to come out, you know, out of the closet. There were this, there were that, and they're trying to cheat the world. And for some reason, each time somebody stands up and says this is not right, take a look at it. You've seen it in the national elections. We're going to find out something wrong. We'll discredit the person, and then people are right back to where they were. I really believe in my heart of hearts, what they're using are fear tactics. You frighten me enough, I'm going to go the way you want me to go, and I'm going to spend the way you want me to spend, and everybody else is a bad guy.
Right. Yeah, I feel that way, too. The carbon trading is a multi-billion dollar business.
Oh, sure, no question about it. Now, global warming in and of itself, you know, let's look at what the greenhouse gases, we've been hearing about this for so long. Is there anything to this stuff, the greenhouse gas? It mostly man-made, no question. But for the most part, is there anything to this? Should we really be concerned about it? Or is there somebody behind it making a couple of bucks?
I think there's somebody behind it making a couple of bucks. I think they actually have a dream situation going on here as far as the global warming and any legislation or anything like that that comes out of it. You have these people that are investing... the pro-global warming people that are investing in these areas like wind and solar and other things like that. And what's happening is they're getting governments to actually demand that it be done. They're pushing it on the people. It's costing the people because, like I said, the government subsidizes this stuff, and so it's going to cost us. But the thing of it is, they got a perfect situation here because they're getting the governments to actually make people invest in these schemes that they got going.
There's the point, and I want to make sure that we emphasize this. Government making people invest into quote-unquote schemes like this. Is the government that dumb, or are we talking about people inside the government that are getting some money out of this thing? And I know what that sounds like, but at the same time, those people that are running the country who help run the world, they're not stupid people. So how do we look at what they're doing and realistically see that this is not doing the best for the constituency? How do you stop this stuff? And by the way,
it's just a gradual thing. More and more people have to wake up to really what's going on. People like you and I and 80% of the population of the world are so busy with raising families, going to work, having careers, and making a living that they don't pay any attention to any of this, you know? And a lot of them, You can't even talk to them about the technical aspects of global warming and climate change because most of them have no idea what you're talking about.
Sure, and when you come down to it,
it's because they're so busy.
Yeah, it's called
busy. They don't have time to actually analyze any of this stuff, and so it just goes on and on and on over people's heads, and everything gets instituted. You know, even though it's bad for the people don't pay any attention to it, so they have to invest in it, whether they like it or not.
And when it comes down to, and it's age old, governments come and go, administrations come and go, what stays constant? Business stays constant. It knows what it wants. It wants to make money. And somehow, when you take a look at it, and when push comes to shove, it's who is getting what out of this global warming thing. Al Gore, you know, that's right there. And you said it all. He's living in a place that he shouldn't be living if he believes in what he's talking about, because that's when the worst
of it's
going to
happen. Yeah, if he believed in it, he sure wouldn't be living there. And in today's world, with computers and phone conferences, that type of thing, you know, he doesn't have to go to all of these places that he goes to in the world. You know, if he was that concerned about the environment, he'd stay home and he'd do a lot of his business on the computer.
Absolutely. And it's called, let's jump into our jet and tell everybody how terrible fossil fuel is that runs the jet. So the people aren't seeing
this. One day of Al Gore's life uses probably as much fossil fuels as a year of mine.
No question about it. And I think that's what it really comes down to. And more people are going to have to wake up, and we're going to have to be in a situation whereby we need leaders here, and I'm not going to get political, but we need leaders here. We need people who see what's going on, have the fixes to take care of things, and then move us forward from there. The average person at this stage of the game and the way this country's run today really doesn't have the say. It should be a trickle-down effect, or better yet, a trickle-up effect of the way it's run, and it doesn't work that way. It's run from the top down. And that's where the problem is. And if somebody's making some money, whether it be...
America's supposed to be run by the people and for the people, you know, and
absolutely.
Not to the people like it is right now.
Yeah.
In a lot of things. America's still, you know, one of the greatest countries on the planet. But what I'm saying is we have a long way to go. There's a lot of things that have been happening over the course of the last 20 years that... you know, almost put us in the same category as some countries down in South America as far as the spread of government's concerned.
No question about it. But the point here is you got to have people like yourself that will go out and talk about it and talk about it and talk about it, and maybe somebody else will hear and somebody else will hear. Because when push comes to shove, it's we who elect the officials in. Now, we have no control about how a president gets elected. We have the Electoral College, yada, yada. We don't even want to get into that. But for the most part, we do elect all of the people around him, all of the people who actually can get in there and have a say. That's where the power should be. There should be an awareness of what you're talking about in such a way that somebody can't make money on it. And there, quote unquote, there should be a law against it, whatever that means anymore.
For government officials, yes.
Yeah. Okay, your new book, Conspiracy. What are we dealing with there? When is that coming out?
It's already on the market. It's available at Amazon and a few other outlets, but mainly at Amazon.
Okay, we got about a minute or so to go. What are we going to be looking at with the new book?
Well, I go into explaining some of the misnomers about the cap and trade situation, how that's going to end up costing us an arm and a leg, and most of all, I talk about alternate energy sources like wind farms and solar energy. I go in depth as to how much that actually produces, weight against how much it takes in fossil fuels to keep it running and, you know, to build the parts and that type of thing.
Sure. Tony, is there a website we can find you at, buy the book, find out about the new books?
Yeah, I'm going to be... revamping this site. I haven't really paid that much attention to it because I've been so busy, but it's enviroclowns.webs.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Tony, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really think you should get that word out there, because if we as a people, if we don't know, we're going to get killed with this.
Well, I'm working on it all the time, and it seems like I've awakened a few people in Ontario, Canada, and Maine, because there's a lot of things going on back there now that people are waking up to the wind farm situation.
Wonderful. Hey, Tony, thank you so much. Thank you for joining us tonight.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks.
Good night.
Some of these good night. Days,
you'll feel so lonely. You're going to miss a man hugging you. Need. miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. Talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Hey, I hope you feel lonely.
Molly Fletcher with us. She's the author of The Business of Being the Best, Inside the World of Go-Getters and the Game Changers. She's been she's coined the name, and she's been given the name, the female Jerry Maguire by CNN, negotiated over $500 million in contracts, and has worked with over 150 of the most talented athletes, coaches, broadcasters of our time. She's risen to the top of the toughest professions, one of the toughest professions, and more than just determination and hard work, there's a lot more that goes into it. And now, in her book, she shares the unique set of skills and strategies that have helped her and others reach the top of their game, the top of their careers. Molly, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be on.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Molly, when we're dealing with something like this, it doesn't just happen, doesn't it? It's a learned strategy. If you want to be the best of the best, there are steps to take to get there. You just don't fall into it, do you?
You know, you don't, and that's what really motivated me to write this book, was that after spending 20 years with some of the most elite athletes and coaches in the world, you know, you see so many commonalities, and it's just, there's a common thread that lives inside of these kind of folks, and I wanted to capture all that and redeliver it, you know, for business people to be able to utilize them on a day-to-day basis and implement them, you know, in their respective world so that they could be their best.
Is that thread a learned skill, or is that just something innate with these people that they've built on?
Well, you know, I think there certainly are some innate skills, but at the end of the day, I think you can look at some of the skill sets, whether it's authenticity or accountability or work ethic or patience or, you know, their negotiation skills, certainly. There's so many things that I do believe that people can learn and capture. And sometimes it's almost just reminding them what makes the best of the best, and how do you sort of how do you capture all that and use it in what you do in business. And to me, sports translates so well to business. It really does. And I watch these athletes stand on the mound, you know, in the bottom of the ninth, or coach, you know, with 2 minutes left. And I thought, these things are the same kind of things that business people need to think about when they're walking into a big meeting or getting ready to make a big call or whatever it might be in their respective worlds. And they can use that. So it's been fun.
When it comes down to it, the common denominator between the athlete and the business person, it's the desire to win. Because any way you look at it, you're competing, you're in competition, and you've got to have that certain something within to be able to move through and be at the top of your game.
No question. I mean, you know, they're all incredibly competitive people, and I think the best, you know, Roger Staubach was kind enough to endorse my book and is on the cover, and you know, guys like Arthur Blank, who started that little hardware store called Home Depot, you know, was a big part of the book, and folks like John Smoltz, who's a Hall of Fame pitcher, and you know, they're all competitive. But what I learned as I really watched their lives over the last 20 years, but then when I really sat down with them and talked to them about the book and really pulled out from them, what is it inside of you that makes you so uniquely different? There were so many things that were so similar, and that's what this book is all about, is is capturing all that in 200 pages and handing it to whether it's a CEO or a C-level executive or, you know, a coordinator at an entry-level position at a, you know, at a big corporation or a small, and you capture all that, you can use it. And it'll make them wake up every day and approach the day both strategically and tactically differently. And that's what I want. I want more people. I want this book to inspire people. At the most basic level, that's what I want it to do, is inspire people.
Now, by the way, Home Depot, obviously everybody knows the Home Depot. But what was it that Blank did? I mean, obviously, the Home Depot, physically, it's what it is, but it's him. I mean, that his ghost is through the whole thing. I'm not that he's dead.
Sure.
But the point of contention is what was it about Blank? What did Blank have that the average guy in the street didn't have?
You know, I think one of the things Arthur told me is that he asked a lot of questions to the people that were in it, you know, and around it. And, you know, so he asked a lot of questions, and through those questions he learned a lot about what the market needed and what his people needed as the business grew. So initially he really pulled back and he said to me, he said, Molly, you know what, if you base a business around just a need, you know, if you anchor a business around a need, you're going to be all right. Because if you know there's a need in the marketplace, and it sounds so remedial and so basic, but it's so true, right? I mean, and so he said, look, I based this on the fact that I knew there was a need for something like this. And so we created it based on what we saw as just a real need. And then what Arthur did a great job at, both at the Home Depot and now as the, you know, owner of the Atlanta Falcons, the football team, you know, he listens to people. So he finds the people that are on the front lines, that are touching the sponsors, the customers, whomever it is, that are really touching the people that are writing the checks. And he really digs inside of those people and he figures out what, you know, what's working, what's not working, what do we need to do to win? And he asks the right questions, and then he listens, and he filters that content inside of what is a man who, you know, is very patient and deliberate and intentional and clear on his mission day to day. And then he filters all that and makes decisions. But he's a good listener, and he asks great questions. And that was a common thread that I saw in a lot of the people that are the best.
Let me hold you up just for a second, because I make sure we get this point across, because I think it's extremely important. You know, for all the years that it took him to put it together, to ask the questions, etc., you mentioned the right questions. If I can capture what he did in years within a couple of hours, look what that does for me. Because what he did was he identified the problems out there. And when I say the problems out there, the problems in the, you know, the bottom line needing to be increased, you know, how to bring the customers and so on and so forth. And what he did, he offered the solutions. But it's in the questions that you said. You ask the right question, you get the right answer, and you move forward. But if you're asking the wrong questions, you get the right answers for the wrong questions, you don't get anywhere. So what this does, it consolidates it. It gives you the right questions to ask, what to look for, how to stay focused in what you're doing. So in essence, it's consolidated all the mistakes this guy ever made and the rest of them, and it's put it into, you know, a couple hour of reading and say, this is what we learned. This is how to do it.
Sure. But, you know, and a lot of times I think people at that level, you know, part of the skill around asking questions is that you're anchored against true vulnerability, right? That I think that the really the best of the best, the Roger Staubachs, the Arthur Blanks, the John Smoltz, these guys aren't afraid to be vulnerable. I mean, when you look at the best athletes in the world, they're pretty vulnerable at the end of the day when they stand on the mound or when they're standing in the box with two runners on and they're down by two and, you know, there's two outs in the bottom of the ninth, or a coach that's got to make that call, or a quarterback with 2 minutes left that's going to drive it down the field for his team. You know, those are guys that the world's watching, okay? The stadium's full, ESPN's on, the world's watching, so they're not afraid to be vulnerable. But then when they can take that into not just action, but also into the you know, asking really hard questions that could expose themselves,
sure,
through those questions, they learn how they can get better. And, you know, that to me is something that I saw. And then they take all that, right, Michael, and then they become accountable against it. You know, the best of the best are accountable as well.
Yeah, but, and there's power in vulnerability. And the reason I say that is this, most people don't want to be vulnerable. They're afraid of it. You know, it's a weakness. It's not a weakness. Because when you're vulnerable and you're out there and you're standing there in front of it and it's all exposed, nobody can use anything against you. You've got it all out there, and it's yours, and you move with it, and there's that. And, well, you know, the word fearlessness, most people are frightened to death of the word, so you're going to get a little bit of afraid. I had a coach years and years ago say to me, if you weren't a little afraid and you weren't pumping some adrenaline there, I wouldn't give 2 cents for you.
Yeah, that is so true. You know, it was funny. I wrote a book in 2008 as well, and it came out, and one of the things that we talked about is fearlessness. And it is something that when I speak, and, you know, it is the thing that I see audiences grab so often and so much, because one of the things that I talk about is when that little voice sometimes that people have on their shoulder that's saying, uh-oh, you're not going to be able to do this. You're gonna screw this call up. You're not going to be able to execute in this meeting. You know, that voice, that negative voice, you have to have so much passion in your life for what you do and how you do it that it suffocates that fear that you have that sometimes can live inside you. I mean, when John Smoltz was standing on the mound in the bottom of the ninth inning, you know, getting ready to close when he was a closer, he's not standing there looking at the batter going, geez, man, I hope I don't walk him, right? He's standing there going, I am going to smoke it by this guy and sit him down. And that's how the best think. They're fearless in everything that they do all the time. And that's anchored against your point, Michael, a minute ago, their ability and their comfort around being vulnerable. Because to be fearless, you have to be willing to be vulnerable as well, right?
No question about it. It's got to all be out there because that means I've got nothing to be afraid of. How do you lose if you have nothing to be afraid of?
Right, exactly.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And
no question.
I really believe businesses today have got to have that, whether you're a little mom and pop, quote unquote, if you're an entrepreneur sitting inside your kitchen with your computer and you're rolling, or a major business. It's all the same thing. It is that ability to look at yourself, move through it, and get everybody around you motivated in the same way. Because if you don't have a collaboration, a collectiveness within that group, you're in big trouble.
Well, it's funny. One of the things that, you know, I found really interesting, too, is that the best of the best are fantastic communicators, typically, right? I mean, particularly the best coaches in the world, and I think the best business people as well. But they're outstanding communicators, and I think that the healthiest of organizations create an environment of transparency, you know, which kind of aligns with the vulnerability piece that we just spoke about. But to me, they're not afraid of transparency. And if you're not afraid of transparency, you know, it creates an environment that feels really healthy and people feel connected to not just their colleagues, but the leader as well. And I get it, right? I mean, there's only so, you know, you can't share everything with everybody, but at the end of the day, if you create an environment with a fair amount of transparency, I think you can create trust and loyalty and things like that as well.
Absolutely. If I'm an employee and there's transparency, and then and I realize that I'm needed in my position, now I am vested in that company. I may not have a profit-sharing part of the company, but I own part of that company. And once you create that, my goodness, it's very hard to stop you. The other side of business also, and I'm sure each one of these guys know it even within the sports, you don't go outside to grow, especially in today's economy. You start your growth from the inside. You get the collaboration. You find out everything you could possibly do to that customer that you have now to take care of the customer. Everybody's out there trying to get new customers in this marketplace, and they're killing themselves. Because they're losing what they have. They're diluting it. Part and parcel of that vulnerability is saying, I got to be loyal to my customer. I got to be loyal to my employees. Let's get it going here. And that takes guts to do. Molly, today especially, that takes guts to do.
Oh, my gosh. No question. You know, what's fun is I speak a lot. And one of the things I talk about also is just how important it is to build something I call favor columns with not only the people that your customers now, but the people that you want to work with. And my whole philosophy around that is how do you build and give and give and give so much to the people that you want to work with or that you do work with that they always feel like they owe you. So you're giving and giving and giving, and you're creating a platform by which they always feel like they owe you. And so with 200 athletes and coaches, that's really, really hard to do. But if you wake up every day and you be your client for 2 minutes at the beginning of every day, and you think about what's going on in their world, what can I do to anticipate what they need so that I can add value to them, so that I can think about it before they think about it, so that I can do things for them that they haven't even asked me to do yet. When you do things like that, you create loyalty, and loyalty is a hard thing to build in this environment, but it's powerful to have because we're in such a competitive environment that if you can create a platform by which your customers and your prospective customers constantly feel like they owe you, then they can't look in the mirror ever and think about firing you or leaving you.
Yeah,
and
that's
also important in this environment.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And also, don't put a pin on somebody's shirt that says employee number 642-3. We've lost a lot of that, Molly. We've lost a lot of that personal touch, that acknowledgement of being there. And I've seen companies right now, they do that, and if you walk up to one of the people inside, you ask them something, they're too busy to bother with you. They forget you're the one who pays their paycheck. But there's where the key is. It's the customer, and you can always tell what kind of a business it is based on that camaraderie, that connection, the communication between the customer and the employee.
Well, you know, no, I couldn't agree with you more. And one of the best leaders that I ever watched lead was Bobby Cox, who was the general manager of the Atlanta Braves for years and a guy that I've worked with for a long time. And, you know, Bobby will be in the Hall of Fame most likely as a manager. And, you know, one of the things that the world looks at Bobby, you know, Bobby's been ejected, Michael, from more big league baseball games than anybody in Major League Baseball. 268 games he's been ejected from. And you know, when you meet him, I mean, he's just sort of like a big teddy bear. He's a great guy. And so, you know, what's funny about it is the world thinks this guy's this big hothead, you know, that he can't keep his cool, and that when he was managing, and you know, he just retired a year ago, but when he was managing, you know, he couldn't stay calm, and he was going off on everybody. But what it really was about was, you know, Bobby knew who swung the bat, and he knew who hit home runs and singles and doubles and who fielded the balls, and it wasn't him. So whenever a player got in a dispute with an ump or there was a confrontation on a call, Bobby would run out there, and he'd put himself in between the player and the ump. And because of that, he would take the ejection and calm his player down and push his player back so this player wouldn't take the ejection, so that Bobby would stay in the game. So that the player would stay in the game and then Bobby take the ejection. And, you know, and so the world thinks he's just this hothead that can't remain cool, but at the end of the day, it was because it wasn't about Bobby. And that's what a great leader is, right? It's not about them. It's about the people that help you do what you do. And, you know, and I think he's just a tremendous example of a guy who led with great humility and, you know, led through influencing others and through coaching and teaching, a guy who remained completely curious all the time about the things that he needed to do and for his guys to do to win. But at the end of the day, it wasn't about Bobby, and I think that's what so many leaders need to be reminded of consistently, is it's not about them. It's about everybody else. It's around you, helping you win, and that's
about. Absolutely. And by the way, isn't that like that? If you brought it into, bring that home. Isn't that the same thing? I think that's what we're missing across the board. Your home and your business. There should be the same kind of environment with both. And all of a sudden, you've got some formulas for success. Molly, we're running out of time. Let me ask you this: website we can find you at, buy the books, and follow you.
Well, you're sweet. So my Twitter handle is Molly Fletcher, and so you can follow me on Twitter at Molly Fletcher. And then my website is www.mollyfletcher.com. And, you know, the books are for sale wherever books are sold. You know, they're physically in every bookstore all over the country. And certainly it's on Amazon, and there's a video there that can give you some clarity around the book as well. So I appreciate you asking that question, Michael. And I just, at the end of the day, I hope it inspires people to wake up every day and be their very, very best. That's what I want. That's what I wrote this book for.
Wonderful. Hey, Molly, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Absolutely. My pleasure. You guys take care. Thanks.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime,
and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Now that's all. Now that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a long time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And Barbara Kazam with us, and she's the author of How Organizations Deliver Bad Customer Service and Strategies That Turn It Around. She, again, is the, and listen to this, because it's an extremely important title. This happens to us every day. How Organizations Deliver Bad Customer Service and Strategies That Can Turn It Around. She's a former chemist. She's a sought-after business speaker who's spoken to more than 35,000 people in 7 countries and has received 27 awards for sales achievement and outstanding trainer ratings. And let us say, Barbara, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. Did I pronounce your last name right?
Sure. Kazam, Kazam, it's all good.
Kazam. Oh, no. What is it? How do you say it?
Okay. Well, it's correctly Kazam, but I like to say Kazam. It's more fun.
Yeah, that sounds good, too. Kazam is the way to go. But Kazam is good.
That's right.
All right. Now, let me ask you this. Very important, because in your bio, you've been to 7 different countries. Is customer service the same definition country to country to country, or based on culture, is it going to be different?
That's a great question. And what I have found is that you're right. The definition of customer service can vary. So if you can have a baseline definition of what it means, and to me what it means is that respectful, kind, like the basics, that respectful, yeah, kind communication. So if they all kind of believe in that, but different, you're right, different countries definitely have tweaks off that basic component.
My brother was here for about 10 days, about a month ago. He came to visit, and we went to a local restaurant in town, which I'd never been in before. And I sat there in the restaurant, and I watched what happened, and it reminded me of what life used to be like. As we sat there, people walked into the door. The waitresses and the manager, everybody say, "Hey, Bob, how are you? Sally, how are you? Good to see you. What's going on with the kids?" I watched, and I, you know, even if the food was lousy, I'd go back. Customer service.
Yes, 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 that's it, exactly. And you know what I have noticed in all the research that I've been doing, and with my current clients, is that the most successful customers or companies are actually doing that. They're doing the extra things. They're remembering names and smiling. The companies on the bottom part of the grid are not doing this. So that's absolutely right. And, I mean, if you drive by any strip mall nowadays, look at what, 30% of them are vacant?
Sure.
And I'm sure part of that has to do with customers. How are they treating the rare customers that do come in, how are they being treated? And it's very rare that the top-performing customers or clients and companies are doing that. So it's nice that that's still around, huh? It's just rare.
Sure. And, you know, and let me tell you what I would bet on, Barbara. Bet on that. Let's say there was a small company It could have been, you know, a stationery store, a restaurant or something that had that kind of customer service and was having trouble and was worried about going out of business and was thinking about it and let their customers know. And if the customers loved what they got there so much, they would tell their friends to go because we want to keep them in business. And I would bet any amount of money that that is an absolute possibility.
Absolutely. I agree completely.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's extremely important. And, you know, I got to a point where you'd walk into some of these big companies and, you know, it would be associate number four. They don't smile. They don't talk to you. They don't do whatever. There is a young woman that is here locally. She works in two different businesses that I walk into. One is a market and the other one is a hardware store. When I walk into the market, it was shocking. The last week I got this loud and clear. I had to realize it was the same woman. I walked into the market, and she's always there. We talk. You know, she's got a couple of kids or dogs, and it's fine. In the hardware store, she's kind of standoffish. There's a wall between her and the customers, and I've walked in there and said hi, and she hasn't even really returned a smile to me as if she didn't know who I was, and I didn't. I was thinking, do you have a twin sister or somebody who looks like you? It was interesting. Two different businesses, same woman, completely different attitude.
That is so interesting, because with a lot of, it's so funny, because with a lot of my clients, we teach a lot about environment, that yeah. The environment where you work impacts the employees' behaviors there. So that's a perfect example of that. In one environment, she's probably with people who are positive, she probably has good role models, she's probably given rewards for doing the right behavior, and in the other one, they probably don't do any of that stuff. They don't care about the customer as much. So that's a perfect example of that.
Yeah, and same person, two different, completely different businesses, and the businesses are next door. You could walk to the other one. And I think the real problem...
Wow, that is amazing.
Yes, and let's say, for instance, you have a business, and I know that you address this. You have a business, I walk into the business, I'm not real happy with it. Well, 30, 40 years ago, I would tell five or six people, and that would be the end of it. I get on and Google, and I use any of these social networking outlets, I can tell 2, 3, 5 million people how bad you are.
Exactly.
That's scary.
Exactly, and it's a problem. But, you know, there's benefits to the consumer in that the consumer, I believe, has more control over their customer service experiences than ever before.
Yeah.
But companies have got to be aware of this, and I believe companies have got to be more interactive with the social media, with their customer service. So it's not just face-to-face or on the phone, they've got to be interactive with all the social media sites, too. And to circumvent that, that's a very good point.
Yeah. Now, by the way, where was it for you that triggered you to get into all of this, this particular specialty of yours?
Customer service, that is?
Yes, yes.
Well, you know, I think it all came from the traveling that I've been doing. I've been doing so much traveling with all my speaking, and I got so sick of being treated so poorly. For some reason or other, I'm very, very sensitive to customer service situations. And if I get treated well, like in the example that you had earlier, I would tell that person how great they were, exactly why they were. And they kind of think I'm weird when I do this. I tell their manager, I write them a letter. I mean, that's how passionate I am about it. But the problem is I'm also very sensitive to it. So I think just the fact that I've been traveling so much and been around so many different scenarios that I decided to focus on that. Because, you know, can you imagine if we could turn this around, if we could make people be more kind to one? And it's not even just at work, it's everywhere. If everyone could be more respectful and more patient with each other, I mean, everything would be better. So that's why I'm so passionate about it.
By the way, I'm constantly doing that. If somebody's really good, I'll walk up the manager, or if there's a manager standing there, I will do something like, you know, hey, you know what? This is a keeper. And just small things like that. I mean, that makes all the difference in the world, which causes that person that you've said that to be 10 times better to the next person and the next person and the next person. And why can't
exactly.
we have that? Yeah. No, I'm all for it. I think customer relations, customer service is critically important, and especially in the marketplace today where you don't even know if you're going to be in business tomorrow. So you've got to do everything
exactly.
you can possibly do to keep that customer.
Well, you know what I think some of the problems are? I think here's a couple problems. One is that I think some companies are rewarded for bad customer service simply because of convenience. And what I mean by that is, for example, down the street from where I live, there's this little mailboxes kind of a place, and it's very much closer to my house than the post office, which is way on the opposite side of town. But their service is horrible. They don't remember me ever. They never say my name. They never smile. They are absolutely rude. But I go there simply because it's convenient. And I think some customers do that as well. They don't change their bank because it's too much of a pain to change it, or their mortgage company. So I think some companies are winning out with bad customer service simply because of convenience, which is a problem. But I think another thing that's happening is with all the downsizing that's going on, there's fewer employees that are overworked and they're undervalued. So they've got way too much on their plate. A lot of my participants in my workshops, they're saying, we have way too much to do. We can't be smiling and be nice to people when I've got all these other things to do. And that's turning out to be a problem. And then one more thing, if I can say.
Okay, let me just with that point, I don't want to forget this. It's very important.
Yeah.
You walk up to one of the employees in one of the markets while they're stacking something, and you ask where something is, and they don't have time for you, and they brush you off. They forget
who is
responsible for their paycheck. They work for you.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's right. And in a lot of my consulting with my clients, I really believe it's a top-down approach. If upper management, CEOs, the big wigs, if they are not communicating to everyone else the importance of customers are number one, well, they're not going to get it. If they keep adding on their to-do list, you've got to stack this, you've got to move this, and the customers get moved to the bottom of the list, well, of course, they're not going to get that treatment. So that's another key component, is it's got to start from the top, I believe. In truly successful organizations, that's how it works.
No, there's no question about it. But the top has got to have that ability to see what the real problems are. You cannot solve a problem if you don't know what the problem is. And most of the time, the problems are hidden, these quote-unquote, let's call them a mask. They don't see what it really is. It's invisible, and then it takes somebody like yourself to walk in from the outside and see what they don't see. And then all of a sudden, it's like, oh, I didn't know that was wrong, and it was there all the time.
You know, that is so funny you say that, because when I consult with my clients, what a lot of them will do, this is what a lot of companies do, is they spend 90%+ of their budget on marketing and advertising. Get the phone to ring, get the customer to come in, or do something online. Then when the customer finally does something, they are treated with rudeness or disinterest, and they lose the customer right away, because only 10% of the budget is spent on learning how to handle customers. So it's a problem with them. And so what I do, my team and I do, it's pretty cool. We go in and we do a lot of mystery shopper experiences. We pretend like we're either patients or, you know, customers. And we give our reports to them, and only then do they actually get it. A lot of times I'll tell them, oh, you know, you need to work on your car. They don't get it until I give them the report, and I have specific instances and dates and times and names. And then they're like, oh, my gosh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
So that's a good point, is they can't see it. You know, they don't know. They're not measuring the right things, I think, a lot of cases, too.
Well, I think the key is, too, let's say if somebody's got a call center. How do they know what they're saying in the call center, and how do they know if the call center is really doing the job for them? Because what is this? And I know the 29th of February, I'm going to get my $1 million and my $5,000 a month from Publishers Clearinghouse. I know I am. But that said.
No, I'm getting that, I think.
Oh, you got it. Okay, I'll split it with you, then we'll be happy. Okay, but the point was, I got this thing finally in the email and said, you won a $100 voucher for gas. I said, okay, cool.
Uh-huh.
So they call up and they said, okay, you know, you won a voucher. I said, great. And then the guy starts selling coupons to me. And I said, I don't use coupons. What do you mean you don't use coupons? I don't use coupons. Got a little upset. And he moved right from there to get me a... my credit report. And I said, I don't need a credit report. And he got a little upset with me and basically hung up on me, and I didn't get the $100 voucher. You see, there's something wrong with that. It stopped me from doing the rest of the Publisher's Clearinghouse stuff. And you get a major multi-billion dollar company like that, and one person on the other side of the phone that they're not controlling and they're not working with, they don't have you back there, can kill a lot of people.
Exactly.
Now, if I do get that voucher the next day or two, I'm going to call you and say I was wrong.
And you'll give it to me, or no? Okay.
After when I was split, wait, you split your mill and the $5,000 a week, you got half my voucher.
Okay. It's a deal. But you know what I found, especially with call centers,
yes,
is that the most successful call centers do a lot of monitoring. There's a lot of monitoring going on. So they're tracking script. There's a lot of script. And, you know, a lot of people are against scripting, you know, like specific phrases. But scripts work. They work in sales situations.
They're wonderful.
They work in customer service.
They're,
you know?
Yes. The scripts are the best thing that you can do. You don't have to sound like you're reading anything, but it keeps
That's
you
right.
focused. It keeps you on track.
That's right. I agree.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was getting excited. Go ahead. I'm into the million you're splitting.
I said I agreed. I was thinking about how I'm going to spend your winnings.
Oh, okay. Well, this is good too. So we've got it split half and half. As long as I get the voucher. I don't get the voucher, we're both in trouble here. No gas,
okay,
no
all right.
place. All right. So customer service. I think we forgot what it was like about 20 years ago, 25, 30 years ago when the mom and pops were around. And that's really what we need to be able to ensure business. And the bottom line with all of this, what you are offering these people is a solution how to increase and or maintain the bottom line. Because without the customer
That's
service,
correct.
it's going to get depleted and maybe not even be there.
Absolutely. And especially in today's economic climate, shall we call it that, the customer, especially when business volume is so low in a lot of places, every single customer counts. And we cannot afford to get a customer to come in and then lose them right away. You know, companies cannot afford to do this. And in fact, you've heard of Zappos.
Oh,
you've
sure.
heard of Zappos, right?
Yeah.
Well,
Zappos.
What they're doing now in this economic climate, you've probably heard of this, is they're now refocusing some of their monies on their VIPs. Yes, they still treat their incoming clients well, but their VIPs is where they're spending more money, and they're investing in that because we all know it costs six times more to get a new customer than to retain an old one. And that's what really successful companies are doing, is they're investing in their current customers. But if we're scaring them away and we're not treating them well, that's going to be a problem. And we see it over and over again.
No question about it. As a matter of fact, when you really come down to it, customer service is a learned skill. There are people who are natural at it. There's no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
But if there are certain
mm-hmm.
things, you know, quote unquote, if you have to script somebody and train them how to come in and mm-hmm. get in there and smile and do whatever it takes to do, my goodness, do it when it comes down to it. Okay, Barbara, we're starting to run
Absolutely.
Out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. My website is www.badcustomerservicetips.com.
Wonderful. Barbara, hey, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time, and hopefully more people who hear the show will smile when they sell something to someone.
Yay! That
Yay.
Would make my day.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, good night.
Bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Kelly Sayers with us, the author of Discovering Your Life's Purpose with the 5 P's to Prosperity. Kelly's a certified in spiritual life coaching, pranic healing, and neuro-linguistic programming. Also, an advanced angel intuitive and medium. She provides private coaching sessions, weekly web events, live workshops, programs designed to help people reach their full potential. She also has a collection of CDs called Meditations with the Angels in her book, Discovering Your Life's Purpose with the 5 P's to Prosperity. Kelly, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much for inviting me. Very excited.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. What time is it in Australia?
Well, it's 9:30, so it's a great time for me. Thank you very much.
That's good. It's in the morning. By the way, there are so many people who live their lives, and I think they just don't get, Kelly, that there's a little people that are looking over your shoulder all the time, and when you're really in a problem, they're there for you. And I think they're called angels. When did you first realize that angels were around? When did you get your first experience?
I think as a child, I always experienced angels, and I actually thought that it was normal, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
But as I grew up, I think that what you believed as a child becomes blocked in you because people think, oh, you're in your imagination, it's all in your head, and, you know, you're just in fantasy world. So people would make fun of me as a child. So I think that as I grew up, I actually blocked it out. And then 17 years ago when I met my husband, I started to meditate again. I started to remember. I started to write in my journals every day and pray to the angels to come back into my life. And then I started to have more angel experiences. So, yeah, it's about that self-confidence and belief in yourself.
Now, by the way, you don't necessarily have to see an angel, do you? Or sometimes do they leave something to say, I'm here, a sign, a something?
Yes, I believe that in the way I experienced angels was through my inner knowing, which is called claircognizance. And you have this absolute knowing and you can sense the angels around you. It's like you have they come through me and through my aura, and so I can sense the presence of the archangels around me. And you do notice the difference because I feel sometimes lost and, you know, insecure and disconnected, and then when I call on, like, especially Archangel Michael, I can feel his presence and I can feel this extra power inside of my body, and it's like I raise my vibration. I feel safe and I feel connected and I feel like basically that I have the courage that I perhaps wouldn't have had without the angels around me.
Kelly, most people live their life, they're alone. And when I say they're alone, you could be in crowds of people constantly. But if there's no one to relate to, no one to connect to, you're absolutely alone and there's no question about it. And I really believe if you know that the angel is there, your angel, whatever that is, and I'm not an expert, but I'm there with you on this, that if you know the angel is there, then you're not alone. When in your deepest, in your most problematic moments, and if you just let it go, you'll find that there's a presence there and you're not alone and there is somebody to talk to.
That's right. I find that when I'm coaching people, a lot of the people that have their angels, it's like they're outside of the door. You know, angels like to show me through like analogies or through visions. And people say, I pray to the angels and I don't receive any guidance. I don't believe that they're there because they're not listening to me, sort of thing. And so I look at their energy and I say, because it's like they're on the outside of the doorway and you've shielded yourself with fear and disbelief that you can't sense the presence. It's like, or I say to people, like a radio station, say the angels are in the vibration or the signal of love and you're in your ego, then the frequencies aren't matching. So, you know, that's why I say to people, if you let go, open the doors and start to do something that feels good and start to believe and just say to yourself, even though I can't see, feel and hear you, I know you're there. So I'm asking for your guidance and protection. And before you know it, you will start to feel a little bit of relief. But you have to let go and you have to open that door and just start to do things that make you feel a bit better, you know.
Now, each angel has its own purpose, doesn't he or she? Are there genders with angels, or does it go beyond that?
There's like different realms of angels. There's spiritual guides. There's ascended masters. And what I deal with my new book, I talk about the archangels and the different purposes of each, even archangel. So it depends on whether if you have a sincere intention to heal a relationship, like you would call on Archangel Raphael, if you were looking for some security and protection and to discover life purpose, you would call on Archangel Michael. Perhaps, but some people say, well, I don't know who the angels are and I don't know their purpose. It doesn't really matter. All it is that you could just pray and say, you know, dear God and the angels, please come into my life. I would like to heal my relationship, or I'd like to discover my life purpose, or I would like to X, Y, Z. And then you've activated that guidance to come through you. But you've got to listen to the guidance and take that inspired action. You know, you can't just sit on the couch and expect the angels to do the work for you, because they come through you. So you have to be a bit active, you know?
No, absolutely no question about it. Now, I want to talk about a word called purpose. Kelly, most people go through life, they have no idea why they're there, what they should be doing, and they get lost, and they live, but they don't necessarily live. They don't experience any kind of a life that they could experience. How do you find your purpose? How do you define it individually?
I think, number one, how I had a burning desire to discover my life purpose, but I would ask, I would pray and say, who am I? You know, why am I here? What is my life's purpose, and how can I make a difference to others? I think it's first of all by asking the right questions, and then perhaps looking at the things that make you feel good. Look at the things in your life that you're good at. You know, what are your strengths, passions, and interests, and your gifts? And start to take it's like a jigsaw puzzle sometimes. And I think I start with what you're good at. Start with what you know. And then you can ask and activate the angels and just say, please guide me. You know, am I here to transform people's lives? Am I here to, you know, to solve people's problems? Am I here to, you know, to invent something, write a book, whatever it is? But with the new book that I've written, I've been inspired by the angels to write this book. There's lots of questions and analogies and all sorts of tools and techniques that can help people really discover and know who they are.
Okay, and I think that knowing who you are is probably one of the most critical things that a person can live through. You can go through academia, you can go through experience after experience after experience, but the one search is always, quote-unquote, who you are. And I think it would be great if families got something like this, because it could be the bonding process. What causes kids to get into trouble when they feel non-accepted, they lose the identity. So they go someplace else to find it, and sometimes it's not the best place in the world to capture an identity. So in essence, if this got taught young, you know, whether it's going to be in the churches, the synagogues, wherever the case may be, there has to be some kind of an awareness of this, that there is something more than you are, than you out there. And I don't mean you, Kelly, but you in the general sense of the word.
Yeah. I don't find that it's important that you feed your mind with good, healthy, like, you know, you say, if you want to have a healthy body, eat good food, put good food in your body and good tunes and good clothes and exercise and whatever, you'll have a better body, a healthier body. It's the same thing with you want to spiritual growth, or you want to discover your life purpose, and you want some you know, some deeper meaning in your life, then there's so many wonderful books out there, and you only have to ask your spirit guides, your angels, say, please guide me to the books that are perfect for me, to the people, to the, you know, to workshops. There's Facebook groups. There's so many people who can maybe inspire something in you. But I really think that good reading, books that feed your soul with good thoughts and help you with affirmations and things like that, that really does make a difference.
No, but by the way, so what I'm hearing you say is that an angel can come through to you in a book. You could be walking down the street and having a problem, and somebody might smile at you and offer you a donut and a cup of coffee when you need.
That's right.
And that could be the angel.
That's right. Sometimes people are expecting, you know, something, I don't know, I say when you ask for money from an angel, they expect the angel to open the door and give you this Archangel Michael credit card. I'd like to see that. But when you ask for money, sometimes they show you a new way to create business or attract new customers or, like you're saying, an opportunity out of the blue, you know, an email might drop in or a song pops in your head that won't go away, and suddenly when you've probably never heard the lyrics, you know the lyrics of the song and you wonder, how do I know that? That happens to me all the time. But it's the words and the lyrics of the song that are giving me clues as to what I'm meant to be doing and who, you know, where do I belong and where do I go, who do I ring, that sort of thing. But again, the book does teach people about how do you recognize divine guidance and what forms it comes in for you. The angels will come through you the way that you believe, the way that you, you know, you're attuned to.
Now, by the way, can it come through something very small? I remember, what was it, a week ago, I was concerned about something, and I walked out of the bedroom. I started to walk down the hall, and there was a feather laying on the ground. Where it came from, who knows, because birds do not fly through the house. And I've got animals here, but they don't go outside. And I asked my sister about it. I said, did you see that? She said, yeah, I don't know where it came from. So in essence, those are the things you don't question. It's like, okay, there's somebody else here. There's somebody watching over. So just, you know, do your stuff, but you're not alone.
Absolutely. And like coins, you sometimes I find money out of nowhere on the floor. You know, I think, where did that come from? Or a classic one was, I was getting ready one day, and I was really frustrated with something in my life, and I was praying to Archangel Michael. I obviously was just in my way. I was just constantly banging my head against the brick wall. And so I would pray with sincere intention. I said, you know, what am I doing wrong? What's going on with me? And my little five-year-old comes around the corner, and she said, Mummy, 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 do you want to hear my new song? And I said, well, okay. And she said, please, thank you, please, thank you, please, thank you, magic, magic, magic. And so I laughed, and I thought, that was what I really needed to know, because I was asking, but I wasn't I wasn't being grateful, and I wasn't being expecting my good to come. And so my little girl, so, you know, as I asked, the angels came through my little girl, and they actually do that quite a lot. And my little girl opens her mouth, and she says the most profound things, and she's 5 years old, and I know it's come from the angels, not from her.
3 weeks ago, I think maybe not even a month ago, I was in the bedroom, it was in the morning, I was getting dressed, And I looked down right underneath the dresser, and there was an English pound, a silver English pound coin. And where it came from, I have no idea, because I have vacuumed under there before, and I've cleaned it under there before. But this coin was sitting there, which I thought was kind of interesting. And then I read something, and it said, if you've got something that you're hanging on to for luck, give it to somebody else who might need it. And I gave it away, and it was very interesting, but that coin just appeared out of nowhere. So realistically, if you allow yourself, it'll happen. And I think you said it all early on. If you've got a different vibration from quote unquote an angel, whatever you want to call it, whatever that belief system that you have is, that if you've got one vibration and the angel's got another one, you're not going to connect. That's what I heard you say. So you've got to be able to get in the flow of what it is that you're looking for before you allow them to come in. You have to open the door for them.
That's right. I believe I would prefer to live in my life of abundance and miracles and thinking that everything is a sign. I'd rather go over the top than I would go the opposite of thinking that there is no signs and there is no synchronicities and there are no miracles. I really believe that the more you align yourself with looking for the miracles, even if you had a daily inspiration journal where you said at the end of the night, okay, what miracles did I notice today? What signs, synchronicities, or accomplishments? Just every day, what am I grateful for? Your mind will start to, you know, start looking for more and more miracles every day. And like you said, the coins, the feathers, the little girls singing, just those, you know, something that pops out of the email, you get unexpected invitation. Those little things eventually make you remember and believe. And when you believe, then you'll see more of it. It's really just your belief system and opening the door.
Yeah, and if somebody says to me, you're absolutely crazy, well, you know, with believing that, and then my comment to them is, I'm having a good time being crazy.
That's right. As long as I'm happy, who cares?
More than they've got. We've got about a minute or so to go. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at, buy the book, follow along to see what you're up to?
Okay. Well, you can come to my website. It's www.kellysayers.com. That's my own personal website for private coaching sessions, events, and everything that we have available. And you can join the newsletters. The other thing is that you can go to the Balboa Press bookshop, and you can order, because you're in America and I'm in Australia, it's easier to obviously buy the book through American, through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Balboa Press. And, you can just buy that online. And just type in Discovering Your Life's Purpose with the 5 P's to Prosperity. And, of course, my name, Kelly Sayens.
You know, by the way, I know you do, because of the bio, you do consultations and coaching and so on and so forth. You know, years ago, if you were in Australia and I was in America, it would be next to impossible to be able to get together. But now we have something called Skype, which I'm pretty sure you're on right now. And you could be dealing with somebody one-to-one, and especially You've got Skype, and you've also got the video with Skype, and you can be talking to somebody tens of thousands of miles away, and it's like they're sitting right across the desk from you. So working with somebody is very easy, and if somebody wants coaching, you got Skype, you got all kinds of ways to do it now where it's not impossible, and it doesn't cost an arm and a leg, and you can actually see the person that you're dealing with.
That's right. And also, because I work on the, like, I read people's energy, and I do receive the messages from the angels, you don't have to be physically with me. Yeah, it's just as easy through, you can be sitting anywhere in the world, which I already do international coaching, but yeah, absolutely. So if people want to write to me, email, inquire about the private coaching sessions, as I said, you can go through the website or just go to kelly@betterlifebookstore.com.au and perhaps write me a letter or inquire about, you know, different coaching packages that we have. So, yeah, you can ask me anything, not a problem.
Wonderful. Hey, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you very much, Michael. It's great to meet you.
Oh, me too. And thank you. And good. Well, I get away. I said good morning. It's good night. Good morning. Okay. Take care.
Thanks, Michael. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Off comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
The moment, and as the moment ends.